Hello, world. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. In schools across America, students are learning foreign languages like Spanish, French, and increasingly Mandarin. But should more of them be learning a different kind of language, the language of code? Everyone from NBA star Chris Bosh to New Haven Mayor John DeStefano says we need more coders to meet the growing demand for computer programming jobs. A team of super coders even got hired to fix one of the nation's biggest computer glitches in recent years.
Of course, you've probably heard that healthcare.gov, the new website where people can apply for health insurance and browse and buy affordable plans in most states, hasn't worked as smoothly as it was supposed to work.
President Obama says he brought in the best and brightest to fix some buggy code that slowed the launch of his signature health reform. Coming up today, we'll be joined by an editor at Wired who is joining the push to teach coding to more Americans. We'll be joined by a local web programmer who's part of the small female computer programming population. And we want to hear from you, especially if you're a computer programmer yourself. How did you learn the craft of coding? Should we be teaching computer science to more students earlier? 860-275-7266. Join the conversation at 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at wherelive. And we've already got a conversation about the show going at WNPR.org. Let me welcome in Lon Seidman. He's a technology reporter at CTTechJunkie.com. We always turn to Lon whenever we have one of these big computer sort of questions. So, Lon, thanks for joining us once again.
Good to be back.
Now, it seems as though coding is really hot right now. Do you sense this in the world?
Yeah, I think there's try to find one, a coder. They're at a premium price these days, and it's becoming something that I think more and more people, as their businesses interact with the web, need someone to help interpret the input of a user to their computer systems. And that's why coding is really a pretty hot place to be right now.
You know, we heard about bad code maybe being the early downfall of this healthcare.gov site. I mean, what do we know about this? Have we really learned that indeed maybe it just wasn't built the way it should have been built?
I think it was built to be too complex, and that may have been more of the issue. There's a lot of code there, and there's, you know, millions of lines of code that people have been talking about. And a lot of it, you know, really comes down to the fact that they are trying to connect new things to old things. And the big federal bureaucracy that we have, there's a lot of old code there. There's databases that have probably evolved since, you know, the advent of computers to track all the Social Security data and other things that then had to connect to things like Experian, which is a credit monitoring system to make sure that people were entering in their information correctly. And I think the vision was to create something that was almost like buying a product on Amazon. The problem is that there's so many choke points in which data had to be verified and maybe converted from one format to another that you really can't do those sorts of things in real time. And that a lot of folks that I've been reading about, people trying to figure out exactly what happened, and the government hasn't really disclosed exactly what all the problems were. But the going consensus seems to be around this piece of middleware, which basically interacted with the health exchanges locally, like the one here in Connecticut, but also the website that the federal government built for people to apply in states that didn't have their own exchanges. And the growing consensus seems to be that, you know, there was choke points that would happen there and that maybe they should have done something asynchronously. So, for example, when you buy a product on Amazon, the credit card verification doesn't happen the moment you click the button to order. It tells you after you did the order, maybe 20 minutes later, congratulations, your order's in process, and that maybe they should have had people step out of the process, wait for that verification to happen, and then come back in and continue. And that might have made it a little bit less crazy for folks.
But one of the things you just said I think is important is for all the criticism around the launch of this site and all the millions of lines of code, people said, well, it's supposed to work like Amazon or like Kayak, and why doesn't it? Those platforms were built from scratch to do a very specific thing, sell you stuff. What you're talking about here is essentially marrying one old set of code from way back in the day to something brand new that's supposed to work like Amazon. It's not going to work that way, does it?
No, it just doesn't. I mean, I think we've created this world where everything just kind of works. Technology really is much better. However, you know, like the iPad I have now is four times faster than the one you could buy 2 years ago, but it's still just as dumb. And in fact, computers are very dumb machines that only do what they're told to do. And the more layers you pound onto these things, it gets a lot more complicated because you have to account for every possible thing that a user might do, and you have to test it thoroughly. And we've had a lot of evolution of code and hardware to do that, but at the end of the day, they're still operating the same way they did 30 years ago, which is taking, you know, very specific instructions.
Now, when you say that the coders are at a premium right now, President Obama, of course, now famously says, we're going to bring in the best and the brightest. We're going to fix this problem. Many people who were involved in the launch of this site said there wasn't really enough testing time. Talk about that, the idea that you need to have lots and lots of people testing out the code that's the back end of this really, really big launch.
Right, and that's part, you know, part of it was the requirements kept changing as they were getting closer to the end of the project, and I'm sure those things changed because they were discovering, you know, mapping issues of trying to translate one set of data to another. And can you test something and really figure out how to get real data out of it before you can officially launch it to the public? And a lot of startups will start kind of in a stealth launch where they let people in. Maybe they do the invite system like Google has been doing with Gmail and their Google Glass product to try to adjust to the scale as they go. And the problem with healthcare.gov was, you know, it was turn the key and open for business. And, you know, it's really not a good way to launch something like that.
And you've been involved in some of these, right, mm-hmm. where they're trying to launch something. What they do is they maybe release a little bit of information mm-hmm. to certain people who are part of the industry or give others the chance in a crowdsourcing kind of way to figure things out. That seems to be the new, not only the new economy, but the new way in which computer programming works these days is you don't just launch it and say, it is going to work absolutely on day one.
It never does.
It never does.
Yeah, and part of it is that you need to reserve resources for every user that comes on there. And we run through our media work here with the Independent Media Network, we run servers that host websites. And I've been the one to have to try to, dismantle them sometimes when, you know, things kind of bulk up, that when a user comes in and they're not getting what they're looking for, a lot of times they hit the refresh button, there's new, you know, processes that respond, and you can see this stuff starting to stack up, and it really freaks you out. So I can imagine what it was like when, you know, they had to deal with this, when you've opened the floodgates and suddenly millions of people, some applying, some are just curious. Maybe they wanted to go in and see if they're going to get a better deal from this new thing than not. So you have a lot of things just piling up on there and three really distinctly different parts of the system that all had to work together but were all developed independently of each other.
And that's the other thing mm-hmm. that these commercial sites do so well. They understand that people are going to go on there and just shop. They're not necessarily going to make an Amazon purchase or make a Kayak purchase. They're just price shopping. It doesn't mean every single person turns into a customer at the end of the day. I'm not sure that the Obama administration figured that out beforehand. Well, we're talking about code today on the program here. This big mess up with the code around the healthcare.gov site is one of the things that has got us talking about it, but there's lots more in the news as well, and you can join us 860-275-7266. Nick is calling from Storrs. Hi, Nick. Go ahead. You're on with Lon Seidman.
Hi.
Hi. What's on? What's on your mind?
I just wanted to say that I was lucky enough to have a computer science teacher in high school, and I was one of, you know, very few high schools that actually had this, and I can't even begin to tell you how much of an advantage this has put me. I had a computer science minor in university up at McGill in Montreal, and it was just like every class, I was just at a significant advantage because I had spent 2 years learning how to code, and, you know, it just helped me so much. And, you know, this is what I do now is I work doing combustion simulation at UConn, and it's been incredibly helpful for me, and that's what I want to say.
Well, Nick, thank you very much for your phone call. And one of the things we're going to be talking about is education in this field. How did you learn how to do this, Lon?
Well, I started on Logo, which I think one of our guests is going to be talking about later, which is a little thing on the Apple II where you could move a little thing on the screen and draw lines and have it do it in a programmatic way, and that's how I got started. But I took a class in college on Quick Basic, which was another basic programming language. And there's some conventions that follow all programming, like loops and if-then statements and that kind of thing. And those things tend to go into just about every language in different forms. And I think when you learn those basics, it really helps. And plus, you know, the reason why so many young entrepreneurs who are coders are making so much money is that they have time to do it because they're younger. They have less needs. You know, there's no family things to attend to. There aren't children that they have to take care of. They have time because maybe after school they can come home and really start banging out code. And it's harder the older you get with more demands on your time and your life to be able to spend time really coding things out the way that some, like the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, were able to do.
I clearly spent far too much time playing basketball and watching Brady Bunch reruns. I could have been a billionaire by now. Let's bring in Mark Lassoff, founder of Learn to Program, which publishes online courses on computer programming, especially for beginners. Mark, welcome back to our show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John.
So we just heard from a caller, Nick, who said, you know, he learned in high school. How do you think people are learning how to code these days?
There's a number of different ways people are learning to code. Traditionally, people learned in college. There's loads of college computer science programs. Most of them are very good, and they produce good coders. Although in the last 20 years or so, more and more foreign students are found in those programs and less people who were raised here. Not attaching a value judgment to that. That's just the way it seems to be. Now, also, a lot of people are self-taught. I actually started as a self-taught programmer before I got a degree at the age of 12 with a book and a Commodore 64. And now, increasingly, people are going online to learn. There's loads of venues online where people who have little to no programming experience can go on and not for a lot of money, learn programming. Those programs do produce, you know, good programmers, and as they gain experience, they can become as competent as someone who's gone through a full university program.
Now, one thing that's interesting is the computers that I grew up with and you grew up with and Long grew up with were computers that essentially, if you wanted them to do certain things, you almost had to learn how to do it yourself. But an entire generation now of young people have grown up with devices that are so magical, produce so much wizardry, like the iPad that both Lon and I have in front of us right now, that I think American students could be forgiven for just saying, I don't need to learn how to do this. I can just wait for the next Apple product to come out. What do you say to that, Mark?
Well, there's a huge difference between being a consumer of technology and being someone who's able to create the technology. And what my company does and what loads of people behind this effort to get kids and any adults programming want to do is get people to be inventors of technology, to produce technology. That's an entirely different experience than using an iPad or, you know, consuming a video on YouTube or using Facebook. All of those experiences are valuable, but in the end, producing technology really is a special experience because you're basically producing something out of code that did not exist before. And while not everybody can do it, almost everybody can learn at some level to produce some technology through programming. And I think that's the important distinction. You know, in school, a lot of times there's efforts to get kids using iPads or show kids how to use an iPad. And that's not necessary. My niece, when she was 2, could use an iPad. But to get them to produce something unique, to invent something, that's really where the challenge is. And that's what we need to be inspiring them to do.
We got a tweet from Marley who says, a self-taught coder for 20 years, college can teach you the basics, but newer languages that are hot are not taught in college. Adam tweets at us, I taught myself Max MSP, a language mostly used by artists and musicians. Mark, what are some of the languages that people are learning right now? What are some of the things that you think people really should learn how to do if they are interested in coding, you know, in 2013?
That's a great question, John, and it's kind of like asking what tools someone should learn to use if they want to build a house. The answer is really you want to use the technology, language, or suite of technologies that helps you build what you want to build. So if you want to build mobile games, for example, you probably should be learning C languages like C++ and Objective-C. If you want to build websites, then HTML, JavaScript, and CSS are important. And I don't want to get too into, like, specific languages, but each language has its own job and something that it's particularly good at. Business applications a lot of times are done in what are called .NET languages from Microsoft or in Java. So you first got to figure out what do you want to build? Because I think people are motivated to program by wanting to build something. So if you figure out what you want to build, then you should follow the technologies that are most optimized for building that. And there's probably over 100 programming languages that are in use to some degree today. So it does take some time to figure out exactly what you want to do. If you just want to learn programming and kind of get a feel for it, it's a good idea to start either with HTML, which is interpreted by a web browser, and then add JavaScript, or to learn Python for kind of a more legitimate programming experience. A lot of different options, and it just depends what you want to do with the actual code.
Of course, Mark is talking about if you want to build something, learn the code that will help you build that thing. Lon, one of the things we're going to be talking about throughout the course of this program is there are a lot of jobs out there for people who are doing this. What are the hot jobs that are available for coders right now, if indeed somebody wanted to get into this field, Lon?
I think it's important to have really a broad range of experience in different languages. And again, they're very similar in some ways, and in some ways they're very different. But even with a website, when you look at how it's constructed, you have JavaScript, which is sometimes the user-facing part of code that writes a website. You have SQL, which drives databases, and there's also now NoSQL. So you have a whole different variety of different databases that you can use. There's PHP and there's ASP. There's a whole bunch of different things that you need to kind of know. And I think the broader your experience base is, different places use different languages. So, you know, Google uses one set of tools. Maybe Apple might use something different. And the more the broader the depth of your knowledge and code base are, the better you're going to be competitively.
Well, let's go to Luther, who's calling from Glastonbury. Hi, Luther. Go ahead.
Hi. I've been coding since 1965, from when I was a sophomore in college. And two things. One, I support Lon's point that I later learned intellectually, but it worked for me, learning more than one computer language at the same time, so you didn't get blinders on as a computer person that there's only one way to do it. And second, working in industry all my career, I've seen many systems that were, you know, even hundreds of people working on them for years, and then they implement them, turn the switch on, and after a couple of days, they throw them away and go back to the old system because the system was just built wrong from the ground up, and you don't hear about that. So government and corporations can screw up computer systems. And certainly testing and better design is the way out of that.
Luther, thank you very much for that. And but before I let you go, Mark Lassoff, do you have any takeaways from this big glitch, this screw-up on the healthcare.gov site? As you're looking at it from someone who teaches coders, what did all this say to you?
You know, it's interesting because it's brought the discussion of good coding into the news. And there are practices that have been associated with developing good code for years and years and years. And I think the most important one is documentation. And that's documenting everything you do so a human being can read it. I tell new students that you're writing code for two audiences. The first audience is the computer, which compiles or interprets the code. The second audience, and perhaps the more important audience, is the other programmers and engineers who have to read your code and implement it in another part of the system. And it seems like exactly, as Lon was saying, where this went wrong was the interoperability between systems, between the layers of the system. And good documentation and good testing will almost always lead to a good resolution for these types of problems. And I think it will be fixed in time, but they certainly could have done a better job with documentation and testing before they launched this to the general public.
Mm. Mark Lassoff is founder of LearnToProgram.tv, which publishes online courses on computer programming, especially for beginners. Mark, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John. I enjoyed it.
Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking to a contributing editor for Wired Magazine. He writes about coding and how important it is going to be, maybe more important than, you know, all those kids learning Mandarin right now. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live.
The programmers of tomorrow are the wizards of the future. You know, you're going to look like you have magic powers compared to everybody else.
That's Gabe Newell, co-founder of video game developer Valve. He was one of the speakers featured in a video for code.org, which is pushing for more coding education. We're talking about this world of programming and coding on the show today. You can join us, 860-275-7266. If you learn computer code yourself, or you learned in school, 860-275-7266. Lon Seidman joins us in studio. He's a technology reporter at cttechjunkie.com. Joining us next by phone is Brendan Kerner. He's contributing editor to Wired, and he recently wrote about coding education. Joins us today by phone. And Brendan, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So one of the things that really is key to your article is this idea that so many young kids are in school right now to learn languages like Mandarin or French very, very early in life. And you're making the case that maybe more of them should be learning code. First of all, explain it to us. Is code more like a language or is it more like a set of math skills? Maybe you can help us understand this.
Yeah, so I think that it kind of straddles the line between those two, but I think there's a popular misconception that really young kids, like 5 and 6, don't have the abstract thinking skills to understand the rudiments of code, and I think that's actually false. They actually can understand the basic concepts, and the earlier you introduce those to them, the more of an ironclad grasp they'll have of them as they move on to the more complex facets of it as they get to, like, 4th, 5th, 6th grade.
So how early really are kids being taught? How early do you think they should be taught?
Well, at this point, they're not really being taught until junior high, high school. You mentioned the code.org making a lot of movement in this space. They're really targeting adolescents. But we've actually seen in some small programs throughout the world some real advances when introducing these concepts to kids when they're in kindergarten, first grade. At Estonia, for example, has a nationwide program underway where they're trying to introduce coding to all of the first graders in the nation.
We're talking today with Brendan Koerner, who's contributing editor to Wired Magazine. We're talking about coding on the show today. Let's quickly go to Robert, who's calling from Goshen. Hi, Robert. Go ahead. Hey, Robert, yes. Are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Very good. I'm actually in my car. I turned on the radio, found your program. I'm on my way. I'm a developer, actually, for the past 16, 17 years, on my way to an interview with a company in Farmington.
Oh, so you're on the way to a job interview right now. How's the job market for people with your skill set right now, Robert?
Well, it's quite a strong job market, but there are many layers to finding a job in this job market. That would take probably a program in and of itself.
I can imagine. How long have you been doing this work, Robert?
Let's see. I started coding back in 96.
Back in 1996. If things clearly have changed a lot since then.
They have. They have. It's yes, speaking in terms of things that have developed recently, with up until fairly recently, you had a great deal of the interactivity on the web was done with Flash, and although Flash is still predominant in some areas on the web in terms of advertising, e-learning, that sort of thing. As we know, certainly HTML5 has really become much more predominant. And along with HTML5, the things that power that are the JavaScript libraries, JavaScript and the JavaScript library. So without getting too granular, there is a lot of and something I've been working with in the last year or so, HTML5, mobile, Sensor Touch, which is an HTML5 mobile framework, JavaScript-based.
And I apologize, Robert. I just cut you short just because I want to let you get to your job interview, and I want to move back to our guest. I wish you good luck on this job interview today. Lon Simon, when you hear somebody like this going to a job interview, I guess there are jobs available for coders now. And people are going and getting them in Connecticut.
They are, and a lot of them actually live in Connecticut but work for companies in other states or other places. So I know people that work out of their homes and are either independent contractors, which there's a hot market for independent contractors, just small projects or parts of projects. And there's also, of course, jobs locally that you can work for a company that needs a full-time programmer, too.
Well, you can join us even if you're not going to a coding job interview at 860-275-7266. Back to Brendan Koerner from Wired Magazine. Your piece in Wired starts off with a story of J. Paul Gibson. I'm wondering if you can tell us who he is and what his story is, Brendan.
Yes, he's a computer scientist from Ireland, and he basically started teaching computer science to high school-age children in Ireland in the 90s. And he had a lot of interest from elementary schools as well, saying, well, come in and teach our kids. And he started teaching, 8-year-olds and started moving down the age bracket. So he started teaching kindergartners and using, games to introduce them to the basic concepts of computer science and coding. And he had tremendous results. He found that, years later, the kids that had taken his courses really became much more effective at understanding coding and becoming better coders as they moved through the education system. So he's really been at the forefront of advocating for the fact that, 5- and 6-year-olds should be learning this concept.
Of course, there's so much that 5- and 6-year-olds and even 8- and 10-year-olds are supposed to be learning these days. Do you think that we in our society right now, Brendan, could accept teaching algorithms and computation to kindergartners? Do you think that we're ready to do that?
Well, I think that is definitely be a change in mindset. We're still teaching. I'm the father of 2 young children, one of whom is in kindergarten, and I see the work he comes home with, and a lot of it's pretty basic. It's still the same stuff that I did. And I think there has to be a realization that, our children who are living in a different world than we grew up in, and they maybe have to have different skills at the ready.
Well, maybe you can make the economic argument, because every time it seems as though we're trying to do something in America, we can always say, well, it's going to create jobs, it's going to create a stronger economy. So make the economic argument for us about why we might be ready to invest more in learning computer code early on.
Well, I think it's not just the fact that, you know, there's so many jobs out there for people with coding skills. It's the fact that coding will be a job requirement for people in all sorts of fields. For example, I'm in journalism, and I feel kind of out of luck by the fact that I didn't learn coding early, and I can't do a lot of the app development and a lot of the story construction on the web that's necessary for my profession right now, because I don't have those great coding skills. So I think pretty much every job will require some coding knowledge in the future, and I think that's the economic case for it.
We got a tweet from Jennifer who says, you really can't enter the library and archives field today without knowing how to code. Wish I'd learned databases. Thank you, Jennifer, for that. We also got an email from Jim, who took computer science courses back in the 1960s. He says, learning to code is valuable because it teaches you to think logically and make decisions while understanding the alternatives, skills that have benefited me immensely throughout my life. You can join us at 860-275-7266 as we talk about coding, especially if you're involved in this world. You know, one of the things I want to ask you, Lon, and maybe Brendan can pick up on in a moment, not too terribly long ago, kids who spent an awful lot of time doing computer programming weren't necessarily considered, well, you know, the coolest kids in school. And now, as you see 27-year-olds worth $8 billion, you start to think, well, maybe they're kind of cool. Do you think that's part of the mindset that's changing, Lon?
I think so. I mean, success is the best revenge sometimes, right? if we look at, like, the Mark Zuckerbergs as an example. I mean, you know what? Becoming Mark Zuckerberg is like winning the lottery. But there is a real basic skill set and almost a technological literacy, even if you're not becoming a full-blown coder. Developing the technological literacy will really help. I think part of the problem we're seeing here, especially with the healthcare.gov, but also when we had the SOPA PIPA discussion, was that policymakers often don't understand the policies they are writing to essentially create computer programs to meet those policies. And sometimes those things don't line up properly. And I think that's a good example of a lack of technological literacy in society.
Brendan, you want to pick up on that? It does seem to be a change in our society in terms of what we value. As Lon sort of puts it, the nerds seem to be having a sort of revenge here by raking in millions and billions in creating things that the rest of us seemingly can't.
Well, I think it's also the omnipresence of gadgets in our lives, you know, the ability to understand how to operate them and make them, you know, kind of bend to your will is kind of really integral for kids today, the same way that being able to fix cars and trick out your car was really big in the 50s and 60s. You know, it's become the most omnipresent piece of technology in our lives, and being able to tinker with that is really valued.
Let's go to the phones again. Ed is in Stratford. Hi, Ed. Go ahead.
Hi. My name's Ed Kane. I'm actually an app developer, too, but I started off programming when I was a kid, taking apart a program on Apple called Lemonade Stand to make it do kind of practical joke things. And then as soon as Windows came out, I feel like that was the time that all my friends who had gone to Windows, I was still doing little bits of code to try to access the Internet, and they were doing all this stuff with their mouse, and I really stopped programming right as soon as I got Windows, until now when the office, when you could program for databases and for Excel, and then getting back into it. Now I actually have an app on iTunes for my magazine, Functional Therapy Magazine, so come full circle.
It really does come full circle. And thank you, Ed, very much for sharing your story. I appreciate it. Let's go to Leandro, who's calling from Brantford. Hello there. You're on Where We Live.
Hello. Hi. Good morning. Thanks for having me in the show. I've been working with technology for 17 years now, and we have a small technology company here in Brantford. And my company, John, my comment, John, is I see that the comments being surrounding learning code, which is extremely, extremely important. I think technology is becoming more prevalent in our lives. You see everyone using gadgets, goes a little towards your comment about the economics as well. The fact that we all have Facebook, and Facebook became so popular, and it's fun to use. That's why, I guess, Mark Zuckerberg became so popular, almost like a hero, right? Now, my comment is regarding primary center on healthcare.org. I think that there's a set of technology that one have to learn. One is coding and understanding computers. And another one is actually looking at the big picture, like the gentleman was saying at the beginning of the show about healthcare.org being so slow. You know, it's integrating with so many other systems that are what we call legacy systems, right? They're old, they're slow, and you need someone who actually have the views, the vision of an architect. There's also this term architecture, technology architecture, to understand the limitations of those other systems that that need to be integrated with, and understand that, well, let's do something a little bit different here. Mm. Perhaps do something asynchronously. So have that big picture and understand how these big systems work. And that's another set of technologies, another set of disciplines. They are intertwined. You know, normally the architect had been a coder before, but knowing and understanding those big pictures and limitations and how things integrate and they work together is extremely important as well and very interesting.
Well, it's and thank you very much for raising that, Leandro. And Lon Seidman, I think he raises a really interesting point. This idea of a technology architect is something that seems a little bit more developed in some way or differently developed than someone who is working on code. Maybe you can get down a little bit in the weeds on code.
Sure. I think, well, and especially in this instance, if we go back to the healthcare.gov example, is that, you know, for many years, the different departments of the federal government had their own IT structures. They still do to a large degree. They've been trying to slowly bring everything under a single umbrella. There's a chief information officer in the government that was only been there for about 10 years to try to get, you know, some consistency to the data, because in some cases, some departments were doing redundant things with massive systems that other departments were doing, because mainly because I guess the whole language of computers and information technology wasn't to share information. It was to provide it to a single department. Now with the internet, everything is a lot more shareable, and we have things like APIs where you can connect to Google's data stream some way, somehow, to make your app work better. You can grab a map from them or do something like that, and the government wasn't really designed to do that. So having someone to architect who knows the weaknesses of the system is important. My family business, this is where I got to really learn how to code, because it was either figure it out or go out of business. we have one really legacy system that runs our accounting system and a newer modern system that does our order entry, and we built the system around the weakness of the accounting system, to know that we can't rely on real-time information from the accounting system. So we set up a system where it will only go out every once in a while, so it doesn't strain it too much. And knowing those weaknesses made our launch, wasn't any less hectic per se, but it wasn't unsuccessful. It was managed and it worked. And I think that's part of it, is really understanding what you have. And it's hard to do that when you have contractors who are really working on their own little fiefdom and not really sharing or working closely with other parts of it.
We got an email from Kareem that says, anyone can learn to code, but learning to program robust, scalable, and maintainable systems requires mentorship. Mm-hmm. There's the concept of software craftsmanship that's been gaining acceptance lately. It seems that the healthcare website exhibits a lot of symptoms of poor coding standards that software craftsmanship tries to solve. Brendan Kerner, pick up on that. That is an interesting idea, that if indeed you're going to teach people younger and younger to learn how to code, that maybe there's some sort of a mentorship program that needs to happen so people are learning how to do it, you know, the right way.
Well, I think you have to think about this in terms of time over the entire grade school to high school experience. You know, I think we should look to grade school at the time when kids learn the basics. And then when they move into junior high and high school, you move into more of a mentorship model where people are working one-on-one with kind of a master software engineer. But I think they'll get a lot more out of that high school experience if they come to the table with a lot of the skill set already in place.
Now, one of the things in your piece, before I let you go, that I think people might be taking away the wrong thing. I'm just going to read a little bit here. As the media theorist Douglas Rushkoff has observed, and he's been on our program before, you write, "To ignore programming is akin to relying on others to drive us around instead of learning to drive ourselves. The majority of our interactions in 50 years won't be with monolingual humans from Asia. They'll be with machines. So let's teach our kids to tell them what to do rather than the other way around." It seems that many could read your piece, Brendan, as saying it's not as important to learn Mandarin Chinese as it is to learn coding. But something that's already been a thread in our conversation here is that some of the most successful people in this world have a balance of these what we'll call liberal arts studies as part of their lives, that indeed maybe learning how to talk to people in China is going to be just as important as learning how to code and selling things to people in China. Is it fair to make that point?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm speaking here as an English major, so I obviously have a lot of love for the liberal arts, but I also wish there had been more balance in my education, and coding had been more elemental and more integral to it. You know, I think we also have to think about limited resources in our school systems. And, you know, right now we're putting a lot of resources into language immersion for kids, and there's really no organized early introduction to coding in our schools. So I think we have to think about the balance of resources and what would be most viable in the school day for our kids.
Well, let's go to Heather, who's calling from Southbury. Hi, Heather. Go ahead. You're on where we live.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the whole Revenge of the Nerds type of comment. When it comes to learning how to code, I do feel like code is also a creative exercise. And I feel like it's kind of harmful to perpetuate this myth that it's only a left brain activity or it's only for nerds. You know, I wanted to be an artist when I was growing up in school, and but ended up being a computer programmer. And I feel like I'm a stronger person for that. But also that I have been able to use both sides of my brain to do that.
Well, Heather, thank you very much for raising that. And I'll say, I, you know, I'm the one who brought that up. And in part, it's because when I was growing up and when I was going to high school in the 1980s, there really was a much different idea behind what computer scientists were all about. And I feel strongly like that has changed. Like, indeed, more people understand that it's a creative field, that it's not just people sitting in a lab all day long. You take my point?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, Heather, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We got a website comment at WNPR.org from Jack, who says, "We don't all want to grow up to be mechanics, but for those who do, teach them coding. The primitive technology we live with has not advanced in decades. Imagine if you had to know as much about your car as you do your computer to get it to do what you want to do." And Brendan, I suppose I'll leave you with that. You know, when Douglas Rushkoff says, you know, relying on others to drive us around, really, most of us don't have to know how to fix our own cars because they just work. But more and more, we may have to know how to do this. So it seems as though Jack's making your point for you here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's so much power involved in code and so many opportunities for those who can, you know, bend machines to their will and make them do what they want. So I think it's a shame not to be introducing those concepts to our kids at a very young age.
If you want to read more of Brendan Koerner's piece for Wired Magazine, you can go to WNPR.org. We've got links there to this story and others that we're talking about today. Brendan joins us on the phone. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me. Take care.
Now, when we come back from our break, we'll be talking with a female coder, and we'll be taking more of your phone calls for Lon Seidman. He's a technology reporter at cttechjunkie.com. You can join us next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll talk about public interest design. Social design is working in high-risk neighborhoods all over the country, proving that thoughtful, community-involved design ideas really can address some of a community's critical issues and needs. We'll hear from Yale School of Architecture and look at some other examples around the country. That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. I hope you can join us. Today, we're talking about coding and computer programming. Obviously, it's been in the news surrounding the healthcare.gov site. But we want to hear from you if this is part of your world, 860-275-7266. Let's go first here to Derek Koch, who's a CEO and founder of an independent software company. Derek has joined us in the program before talking about entrepreneurship in New Haven. Hey, Derek, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, John. Glad to be here.
Hey, so as you've been listening to this conversation, what's important here to you? Obviously, coding and computer programming has been a big part of your life for quite some time. I mean, do you think it's time for us to start creating more coders, as Mayor John DeStefano said down in New Haven, to meet all these job needs of the future?
Yeah, you know, I think that the products that we create in the future are increasingly going to involve this skill of programming and coding. And even other skills, right, working with data. But it's going to require the same kind of thinking, logic, some of those same abilities that come with software development. So, you know, just locally, as the mayor underlined, our ability to create this kind of talent really, kind of determines how innovative we can be as a local community, you know, not to mention as a nation. So I think it's really important. It's a global issue, but it's also a very local issue.
Well, but talk about that for a minute, too, this idea that in a place like New Haven, there is a community, but what essentially Mayor John DeStefano is saying, and you can read more about this in the New Haven Independent, a story by Melissa Bailey a few days ago. Basically, he's saying we need more people here in New Haven to help jumpstart the specific economy. So even though this is technically, Derek, a job that you could do any place, in order to really make the economy around computers flourish, you need to have a concentration of people actually living together. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, you know, it in some ways it's not all that surprising when you think about the kind of products that we're developing. They're very complex. A lot of the value added in products today has to do with their connectivity to data, their ability to, you know, act in an information context. So, you know, the idea that teams, highly local teams who are working on really creative problems, would be important isn't that surprising. You know, being face to face with people, looking at the same data, talking to customers and users together, and having software development be right there, right, a part of that conversation with the person who's going to get value out of the product is really important. And so I think, you know, he's absolutely right. It's also the case that, you know, we're in a probably a global scene where talent is really migrating to certain centers, you know, Silicon Valley being one of them. I heard a report from an economist the other day who said, well, you know, the economy's not doing that great. But then again, if you jump on a plane and go to Silicon Valley, it's another world. You know, that's a problem. I think it's a problem that our headline unemployment is really still too high. But I think developing these skills and developing these local communities is really part of the key to bringing down national unemployment, but also distributing talent more effectively through the country and allowing Connecticut and other places that, you know, aren't Silicon Valley, frankly, to kind of claim their own role in the global economy.
It would be nice to get some of the talent distributed. Derek Koch, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, John.
I want to welcome in Diana Leroy Schmidt, who's art director for both Searant and also Kriana. She's involved in this world and joins us now by phone. Diana, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So how'd you become a web developer?
Similarly to a few people who had called in before, my background actually started in high school. When I was there in 1996, my senior year, they had the ability to do a co-pilot program where we started to learn to hand code, and it was only a select group of us, maybe like 6 to 8 students. And from that, it led into an internship, which ironically was starting in graphic design, and I did graphic design for all about 2 weeks and then started right into doing web development and web design and haven't looked back.
Do you think anybody can do this, or does it require a special talent? Because, look, you work in an artistic field. Some of us learn early on we're not going to be great artists. Others want to be great musicians. We learn we're not going to be great musicians. Do you think anyone can thrive in this world?
I think the field offers enough opportunities to diversify yourself with different areas of it so that you can find your niche. I mean, there's certain people who logic is that is their thing, and coding, straight coding, is going to be their grouping. And then other people, like myself, I kind of straddle both sides with having, you know, an art background, but also knowing how to actually hand code, which makes it possible for me to better communicate to clients and stuff what the needs are for a project and how to better roll that out.
Well, and that's the big divide here, right? There's the front end and the back end of coding when it comes to a website. And the client often is someone, like, say, myself, who doesn't understand this world, who might want something to look a certain way but doesn't understand how to get it there. So talk about that translation and working on the front end of something and the back end of something to make sure it actually works.
Oh, definitely. The front end, I mean, and that's progressed, too. And me, back in the years, you know, years ago, it was like, you would say, oh, I'm a web designer, and you just did design. Now, a web designer also gets rolled in with like a front-end developer, and you're doing actual markup, and you're doing CSS, and you're probably doing JavaScript. And then there's the actual back-end development, and you're actually doing the programming and scripting languages that are going to interact with the database. And all of those things end up having to come together. You can't, you know, function in a vacuum with just one of those. And that's where, you know, explaining it to a client is kind of explaining the process almost like building a house. You have to put a foundation in, and that's going to be one person, and they're going to be the person who has to do all the wiring. So it's that process, and So using the term architect, too, is very important. I mean, information architects make it possible to figure out how are all these pieces going to go together and what is everybody's role in this project.
We got a tweet from Doug Hardy, who works with Lon Seidman. He says, half the problem for a business is understanding what questions to ask your web developer. Conversations between the web developer and client are often like trying to find each other in the dark, speaking different languages. It's something that I'm sure you've probably encountered a lot, Lon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and again, I think it's a good point that we're building systems now. When the Apple II was the computer everyone used, you wrote programs. It was a very solitary exercise. But now you're building systems that have components that have specialties, a database server, a JavaScript code that runs on the user's local browser, and then a web server that might process other code that's in input from that user. So they are systems, and they need to be architecture behind them now.
I want to go to a quick phone call. Jeff's in Woodbridge. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Jeff.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm just pleased to tell a story and ask a question. So when I was, this was back in the early 80s, I actually was hired by my elementary school to teach other kids to program as a sixth grader, and I taught the other kids to program. So I remember it as a wonderful experience that the kids enjoyed too, mostly because they just explored it on their own. We used a program called Logo at the time. I've gone on to do a lot of bioinformatics and computational biology now, but my question was actually for the other people on the online here. Does anyone know about methods now that – so when I learned to program, I learned it just because, again, we had an Apple II. We could just turn on and start programming. Are there programs or formats now that we can use? Like, I have a young kid. I'd love to let them learn how to program on their own as well. And I don't know of any sort of systems I can set up for them to just do that on computers at home.
Well, it's a great question. Lon?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking a lot about this because I have a six-month-old at home, and right now she can pick the iPhone up and drop it, but soon she's going to want to do something with it. And I almost think booting up that old Apple II again or running it in emulation might be a great way to start because it is so it's simple in the sense that it can't get online. It's hard to get distracted on it because it doesn't do more than one thing at a time. And that, you know, introducing a child to Apple Logo might be a great first step. And then there's things like Alice.org, which is it's been around for a while, a system to help children understand a little bit more of modern programming concepts. So those two things I would look at.
Diane, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I would definitely check out things like the Code Academy and even that Khan Academy and doing just JavaScript. I mean, JavaScript is becoming the thing that, you know, was one of the first things, and then now everybody's back to using it because it can go across so many different platforms. I have friends who are, they have their, like, six-year-old sitting down in front of Khan Academy and learning how to do the basics of, like, setting up logical expressions and making things move across the screen. I mean, it's better than the days of, Commodore 64, pen up, pen down.
Well, Diana, we just have a couple minutes left, but we want to get to one of the big elephants in the room. And we have to ask is the world in which you inhabit still mostly a male-dominated world? We've heard from a lot of male phone callers. We haven't heard from a whole lot of women, but we have heard from some. Is it a stereotype that's been broken, or do you think that this is still true?
It's an interesting thing because when I started attending conferences in the early, mid-2000s, I would usually be one of maybe like 2% of girls in the room. And it's still, especially even for like girls speaking at conferences, only in the past like 2 years, I'd say, that it's really started to blossom. There's a lot more. There's all these different groups now, like Hack and Jill and Girl Develop It, and there's different conferences specifically around that trying to bring people out. I think the thing is typically girls were behind the scenes. They are doing it, but it has definitely been a male-dominated field. But it's definitely changing.
Lon, you just pulled up something on your iPad here.
Yeah, there's a program called Girls Who Code, which does like these summer immersion programs. It's a nonprofit that's trying to get more programming skills, or at least develop interest among girls for programming as well.
Diana, we just have about 30 seconds, but is there something that you think that could be done to get more young women involved in this world?
I think just basically making it not seem like it's something that's so technical that you can't understand it unless you like know calculus. It's not. It's not that kind of thing at all. And it's something that you can do on your own and just tinker around with.
Diana Leroy-Schmidt is a web developer. She's art director for Cirent and Creana, and she joined us by phone today. Diana, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks also to Lon Seidman, who's technology reporter at cttechjunkie.com. By the time I see you next time, Lon, I'm sure your brand new daughter will probably be coding.
Yeah, I'm planning to retire, so we'll be ready to go.
Good. Lon Seidman, thank you so much. If you want to join us on this conversation, continue it online. It's WNPR.org. You can just go to our show page and you can add comments there. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives with Heather Brandon. The senior producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.